Thanks for clicking play on the Eastlake Tri-Cities Talks podcast. If you're new to this, we're trying to be the best church option for people in the Tri-Cities who aren't typically into church. We hope today's talk inspires you to take next steps in doing life in the way Jesus modeled and taught. If you're ever interested in being a part of one of our in-person gatherings, they take place every Sunday at the Uptown Theater in Richland. Check the website for current times. And regardless of what you look like, who you voted for, or where your tattoos are, we'd love to have you. But for now, here's our most recent talk. Well, hey, good morning. Welcome to Eastlake. We're so glad that you're here today. It's great to be back with you. I was off last week. I'm a part of a network of pastors who get together once a year and bounce ideas off each other and meet somewhere, fly in together. We're spread out from all over, and we do this thing where we have the same vacation goals that you do a little bit, right? We want to find a place that has a big house. We want it to be relatively cheap and have decent things to do. And you get to pick two of those three things. That's how this always works for vacations. You pick two and then roll with the punches on the rest of it. So we ended up in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. And actually right between Pigeon Forge, Tennessee and Gatlinburg, Tennessee. And so we were right there. We were like right by the world's biggest hot sauce museum and Mirrors O' Fun. That's where we were, is somewhere in there. So you can imagine kind of all that. But it was great. It's a great time to get away. Thank you to Anna. I don't think she comes to second service for covering for me last weekend. But yeah, it was a time to share some stories and do whatever. And we flew into Nashville, and so we had a three and a half hour drive from Nashville. Oh, it was cheaper to fly into Nashville to drive to where we were going. And 3.5 hours in the car with one of my pastor buddies, and my buddy Dave, who's one of our elders here, who now has a church in Seattle, Redmond area. And we did this. We did the game where we're like, well, "What do you want to listen to?" Right? And you can only go so long with radio. And so everybody, so it's like, he's like, "I'm not really a music guy." And I'm like, "Good, me neither. I'm like more of a podcast guy." And he's like, "Well, let's do the pod." And we did the thing where you like have to like find out, you get to know somebody based on the podcast they listen to or the ones that they recommend. Have you noticed that? You're like, "Oh, you listen to that. That's interesting." And so, and we're both like trying to be like maybe spiritual ones or leadership ones to just prove to you that I'm a good pastor, you're a good pastor. And then we got through a few of those and it was like, "All right, I'm ready for like a breath of something different." And he goes, "Well, what do you recommend?" And so I'm like, "All right," he's making me go first. So I told him, "Say More" with Dr. Sheila. You should write that down. It's so good. Anyways, and that was, we laughed at that. That's about a half hour episode or so. And then he says, "I'm into true crime stuff." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And he said, "Dateline," which I'd never, it's like, "The show? What are we talking about?" And it was like true crime meets NPR. It was awful, you guys. I don't recommend that one. I recommend the Say More with Dr. Sheila, but I don't recommend that one. And I'm listening to it, and it's, you know how, if you ever recommend something to somebody and then you sit with them while they're experiencing it and you both know that it sucks, and he'd be like, "Oh, this is a bad one, so sorry." You know what I mean? That's how it always works. It's, "Oh, this one's a bad one," but trust me, that I don't waste my time with crappy podcasts. And I just remember, I'm listening to this thing, and it's the classic, there's like two people, one person's telling a story about somebody who got murdered or killed or whatever, and then the other person is interjecting questions that are obviously scripted, but they're trying to make it seem like it's not scripted, and they'd be like, "Well, did the cop not know that there was a DUI in his record?" Yeah, you would think that that would be the case, and you're like, "Oh my gosh, this is so cheesy, guys." Like, it was so bad, and what they do, what they're experts at, is making it seem very obvious how this is going to play out, or asking obvious questions, or did they not know that? Did they not see that? And all these true crime podcasts are kind of like leading us as the audience to think we're kind of like a little bit smarter than the people investigating this case. You know what I mean? And I can't believe that this verdict went this way and whatever, because obviously now we have all this information beyond it. So it was painful for me to listen to. And again, trying to make it obvious, like all the signs were there. So anyways, we got that listened to. It was done. We made it to the house. We had a great week. But it's great to be back. And then while I'm there though, because we were gone from on Saturday, we left and went to a church in Nashville and got to see that. But on Monday, I get a call from Kylie. And she says, "Hey, there's been something that went down at Wiley Elementary. It sounds like there was a shooting there perhaps." And I was like, "Are you serious? Like in the school or at the school?" And she's like, "I don't know. This was early on, right?" And it's probably the same thing that like all you guys kind of went through. You're like, "I don't know. Something's happened." And And I'm like, is anybody injured or dead? I don't, again, responsive, I don't know. And immediately you start running through things in your mind like, hey, I think so-and-so goes there, right, to that school, or doesn't so-and-so teach there? And so you begin to like run through these questions about all of this, and I'm 1,000, 1,200 miles away, scrambling for information on what's going down, trying to scrape social media to try and get my news or whatever. And I can see, yes, something has happened. Yes, but what? What I wanted was information. What I kept getting was like noise, right? All of this, what we're hearing is dot, 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 right? Or things like there may be as many as dot, 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 whatever. And I'm feeling helpless. And Kylie's emotional. She's been teaching. And so this is kind of like, you know, solidarity with the school district. It could be our kid. It could be our school. It could be whatever, all the scenarios that you run around in your brain. And I kept thinking, imagine if you had a family member there that day. And maybe some of you did and whatever. And you're sitting in that spot hyper aware more even than me. Like, I need information now. Like, somebody needs to tell me the truth now. And slowly, or at least slower than we like, the story begins to emerge, and it's tragic, obviously. And then on Tuesday, Wednesday, more information comes out, and like a picture that's slowly getting more and more refined, we begin to kind of piece together, or like downloading pictures on DSL internet. For those of you who remember what DSL internet was like, and you're like, I think I know what that is. And it slowly comes into glimpse. You begin to see a little bit more information as it comes through. As more and more information comes out in situations like this, we can often find ourselves saying one of three different sort of things, right? One is, a lot of times in scenarios like this, we'd say, oh, nobody saw this coming, right? Whenever tragedy strikes, this is one of the approaches that we take. When often there's not enough information, when the picture is less clear about motives and things like that or whatever. And then the second one is, how could we not see this coming, which is then a reflection of kind of current systems. It's still broad. It's not specific to that individual or whatever, but it becomes like, how did that fall through? What kind of systems in place did not reinforce this or whatever? And then the most damning one of them all is this phrase of all the signs were there. All the signs were there. And that's kind of unfortunately what it can get to. And I'd like to stick with the same process, but switch circumstances to a less recent, less emotional one, because I know that this one is fresh and tender and all of that. But please know, we are actively thinking of ways to support our community beyond a thoughts and prayers post on social media, as all of you probably are doing the same thing as well. And so I want to move away from this story, because I think there's a lot of things and a lot of, I just don't want to, it's too fresh. But it did highlight for me. And by the way, this was a planned series before any of that took place. So I don't want you to think that I'm capitalizing on a tragedy to talk about something. It's tragic and also relevant to, I think, what we were going to talk about anyways. But this idea, this language of, man, all the signs were there. Let's back it up to a little bit more safety from a distance sort of thing. All the way to December 7th, 1941, a day that, according to our president at the time, FDR, will live in infamy, right? We all know that because you remember high school history class or whatever. The bombing of Pearl Harbor and all of the entrance of America into World War II, the advance of the Japanese, and a lot of people saying a lot of these things on December 8th, 1941. Nobody saw this coming. How did we not see this coming? And then eventually, once the information is all out there, man, all of the signs were there. Many signals suggested that an attack on Pearl Harbor was possible and perhaps imminent. Diplomatic relations between U.S. and Japan were rapidly deteriorating. They were obsessed with territorial expansion. America, if you remember, was holding off on their entrance into World War II, trying to be like, that's Europe's war. We don't have the manpower. We'll send stuff over, but we don't want to get involved too much. And everybody's begging America to get involved. And we're like, there's so much tension on this. Not that we didn't approve, you know, or whatever, passive on what Hitler was doing over there, but just, you know, somebody else's fight, somebody else's war. It's not really kind of our thing. And so nations were begging us to get into this thing at this time. And Japan was clearly kind of our other threat on the west coast of things. It was a tough deal. And we knew that they were obsessed with territorial expansion. Roosevelt moved the Pacific Fleet from San Diego to Pearl Harbor to deter such ambitions. And they're rapidly changing their call signs on their radio signals that we had, kind of signaling a little bit for us, the signs that perhaps something was changing, something was shifting, something was getting far more aggressive. And then the most ominous signal of all was their silence. In about mid-November, we stopped hearing, historians tell us, any sort of signals about the fleet, the Japanese fleet in the Pacific Ocean. Though we couldn't always decode their messages, we could at least tell where they were coming from and who was responding. And then all of a sudden, we couldn't. And the explanation from the intelligence community concluded that the carriers were probably close to home waters where they could rely on alternative means of communication. They no longer needed to do the messages over. They knew that that was giving them away. So perhaps we thought at the time they had come close to home to kind of regroup, restock, and then do some sort of an event. That makes the most sense for us at the time of why there was radio silence in this. But as we know now, they were secretly making their way towards Hawaii, taking advantage of blind spots in our coverage area. We didn't have radar at the time or developed radar at the time. It's mostly visual stuff. The ships initially started towards Dutch Harbor, Alaska, and then on December 4th, they took a 45-degree turn toward Hawaii, where 3 days later, they'd launched the morning attack that killed almost 2,400 soldiers and sank four of our battleships. And as history tells us, the next day, U.S. Congress met and declared war on Japan and officially entered into World War II by a vote of 470-1. And historians would tell us that we made all the wrong decisions leading up to that fateful day. The best guess at the time, the intelligence community said our biggest risk is sabotage from the inside, especially when it comes to Pearl Harbor. If we're going to be out that far, which makes sense because it's the closest thing, it's the barrier between us and them, right? So we need to have a presence there, absolutely. But unfortunately, at that time, in their thinking, this is also a place where a lot of Japanese people had resided for a long time. And so perhaps their allegiances would be there. It would be sabotage would be our greatest potential threat from Japanese descendants living in the area. So they stuck their airplanes close together so they could be protected and easier to monitor. Instead of having them spread out, let's group them all together because that would be a much smarter thing to do. What that did, unfortunately, was make them an easy and vulnerable target and made the damages cumulative rather than individual. So obvious was our error, and so obvious were the patterns that, of course, this was going to happen afterwards. The conspiracy theorists came out after the war and said, I think this was America's, they knew that this was going to happen. They grouped them all together to kind of create a catastrophic event so that we would be forced to go to war. These people just wanted to go to war. They wanted an excuse to get into it. So bad were our decisions that conspiracy theory actually made sense for a lot of people. This was written by somebody who had a book come out about the idea of signals and noise when it comes to the Pearl Harbor event. It is much easier after the event to sort the relevant from the irrelevant signals. After the event, of course, the signal is always crystal clear. Don't we know that? Oh my gosh. The signs were all there. Of course. So stupid. How did we miss it? We can now see what a disaster it was, signaling since the disaster has already occurred. But before the event, it is obscure and pregnant with conflicting meanings. It comes to the observer embedded in an atmosphere of noise, i.e. in the company of all sorts of information that is useless and irrelevant for predicting the particular disaster. It's not ever as easy as it looks. After something, we go, oh, all the signs were there. How did we miss it? We forget what it was like to be there beforehand. You ever watched a basketball game with somebody and at the end of the game, they go, I knew they were going to win. Of course they were. That team can't handle the 2-3 zone. This guy sucks. He's injured. It's obvious. It's so obvious after the fact, we say hindsight is 20/20, right? Before the game, you said, what do you think? And then after, you're so confident on how it works. I knew they were going to win that one. I knew it was going to happen. They're always better on the road coming off a loss, blah, blah, blah. How could I not see that? All the signs were there. Because prior to the game being played or prior to December 7th, there are always all sorts of things clamoring to be seen as predictive, as patterns, as obvious ways of telling you and me what comes next and how we should prepare ourselves to face it. So I've titled this series, The Signal and the Noise, because we have plenty of both in our lives. We have the signal, which is supposedly telling us what the truth is, and then we have a lot of noise around us, which distorts our ability to be able to determine what the signal really and truly is. It's a series really on discernment. Discernment is simply a definition of knowing what to do when. I've got it pegged for 4 weekends. I think it's going to be a four-part series because I think that 4 weeks will give us enough leeway and runway to be able to, you know, figure this thing out for life and be able to discern properly everything. I'm just kidding. It's not going to happen. It's going to be, this is a lifelong journey, figuring out what to do when. You as an adult, you look back on your college years and be like, I wish I had more discernment then. But you know, when you're 50, you're gonna look back on when you're 40 and say the same exact thing. When you're 80, you're gonna look back on when you're 60 and say the exact same thing. This never goes away, guys. This is a constant problem. I wish I knew what to do when. I wish I could have seen the signals. I wish I would have ignored the noise a little bit more. When my marriage relationship is falling apart, when things are there, I mean, the signs were all there, but in the moment, I just kept pushing forward, or I called it off too early, or investment things. God, how many times in our investment stuff in the past have you made a bad, I don't want to have you raise your hand because it would just be a sea of hands, but you've made a stupid investment. You looked back on it and be like, that was dumb. And looking back, you're like, I cannot believe I did that. How did I send money to that person on the internet without having, you know, like, I'm like, this is like, I scammed. My dad is the king of Facebook scams, man. I'm telling you, I got a Christmas gift a few years ago. It was supposed to be this like US Open golf shirt, and it was supposed to be like a men's large. I think it was like a kid's small, and it was like ironed on, and I'm like, and he goes, you don't even want to know how much I paid for this. And I'm like, you know, I'm like trying it on for him to make him feel better about it. And I'm like, yeah, this is going to be fine. And I'm like, I'm never wearing this out in public anywhere. You know what I mean? And later on, he's like, yeah, we thought we had these Yeti coolers and my mom was buying these Clark shoes, all these kinds of things. You look back and you're like, you guys need to just unplug from the internet. Save yourself some money. Don't get on Facebook and buy anything. Don't do anything like that. Operate with a level of discernment. I mean, that's the big thing going around, right? We see this and be like, be careful out there, guys. A lot of bad people out there. Knowing what to do when. When there were signs that the marriage wouldn't work out, when there were signs that it was a risky investment, then there were signs that it's a major life decision. You have a major life decision, a move, a job, a change in this, like, you know, have kids, not have kids, whatever, all these things that you're like, oh my goodness. And then you realize like so much time, when you look back, you're like, I'm just reacting to something. I didn't even make that with full like judgment. I didn't play things out. I was so angry. I was so emotional. I was so tired. I was exhausted. I just reacted to something. I did not operate with a high level of discernment. And so we find ourselves going, God, if you're real, I could really use your help here. Maybe this is a big decision now. Maybe this is a timely series because you've got some things coming up and discernment's a big deal right now. And you're thinking, I've got to make some pretty significant life decisions. God, if you could help me, because there's a lot of noise. I'm not sure what is the true signal. I'm not sure who I should be listening to. And that a lot of times it comes down to this. You have a lot of people in your life who you would classify in the noise category. Very few people in life who'd be like, that person's signal. When they talk to me, they usually have my best interest in heart and they usually are thinking at it from a high enough level. And they're not always right. But like it's a lot of times it's a who, not even a what. But oh, that we could have operate with a high level of discernment or wisdom. And we're not the first people to crave this sort of thing. In Israel's sacred history text, we're introduced to the son of King David. I'm picking up off of a story. We just finished in our last series. I led you through a story about David and Saul and whatever. This is just a little bit after that, which kind of works out for our schedule thing. But King David would eventually take over the kingship from Saul. David would have family and sons, and eventually one of his sons, Solomon, would take his place in line of kingship. And the story goes that he's presented in a dream with an opportunity that every one of us has dreamed up of our own, sort of a genie in the bottle sort of experience. It's as if the God of Israel presents himself in a dream and says, I give you one thing, whatever you want, I'll give it to you, right? And his request is he asks for wisdom in order to lead the people well. Probably he's feeling the weight under the burden of leading a nation and one that's probably going to be outmatched in a lot of size and economic stuff with other nations. And so help me to lead well. Help me to operate with a high level of wisdom. And it says, the story goes that because you didn't ask for money, eternal life, or the obvious one, three more wishes, I will grant your request. And it's a likely legend for someone who was characterized as wise. It's probably something, as I'll kind of illustrate for you, that I don't think that God actually operates in this way, because I don't think you're going to go home tonight. Just show up in a dream, give me a wish, and I'll know what to do. It's the classic story. It's a classic trope that works out for us. What would we do if we could have anything? And the idea is they're trying to build a case for the wisdom of Solomon. I no doubt think that Solomon operated with a high level of wisdom. I think that he was so wise, people had to come up with explanations for why he was so wise. This is obviously divine. This is obviously God-given. There must be something here that he had done. So this story comes out and is presented in this way. And one example of how wise he was shows up in 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 16 through 28. In your Bible, there's probably a heading of some sort that kind of defines what comes next. It's called the Judgment of Solomon. Here's what it says. Now, two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him. One of them said, "Pardon me, my lord. This woman and I live in the same house, and I had a baby while she was there with me. The third day after my child was born, this woman also had a baby. We were alone. There was no one in the house but the two of us." So setting the situation for a classic she said sort of environment. And a lot of times the king would, in these cases, operate like a judge for the people or Supreme Court of some sort. They would be handled lesser things over here, but the death of a child, I mean, that's kind of a big thing. So during the night, this woman's son died because she lay on him. She smothered him. So she got up in the middle of the night, took my son from my side while I, your servant, was asleep. She put him by her breast and put her dead son by my breast. The next morning, I got up to nurse my son, and he was dead. But when I looked at him closely in the morning light, I saw that it wasn't the son that I had born, that there had been a switch played throughout the night. The other woman said, "No, the living one is my son. The dead one is yours." But the first one insisted, "No, the dead one is yours. The living one is mine." And so they argued, catfight before the king. The king said, "This one says my son's alive and your son is dead, while that one says, 'No, your son is dead and mine is alive.'" Noise, noise, noise. What's the signal? What's the signal? There's a lot of noise happening here, a lot of different ways, trying to figure out what's true. Then the king said, "Bring me a sword." So they brought a sword for the king. He then gave an order, "Cut the living child in two and give half to one and half to the other." The woman whose son was alive was deeply moved out of love for her son and said to the king, "Please, my lord, give her the living baby. Don't kill him." But the other said, "Neither I nor you shall have him. Cut him in two. Neither of us will be happy. Go for it. Just make this thing happen." Then the king gave his ruling, "Give the living baby to the first woman. Do not kill him. She is his mother." When all Israel heard the verdict the king had given, they held the king in awe because they saw that he had wisdom from God to administer justice. Now, dark story. Is it really? I mean, are we portraying the ethic nature of the king? He was willing to have a sword come out. Was he really going to do it? No, I mean, I don't know. I don't think that this story, I think that the way to read this is not that it actually happened, but this is a way of showing these people, like this guy had creative ways to determine the signal and exclude the noise. His way of doing this, but this predicament, who thought of this sort of thing? Who would think of this? We valorize and we lionize wisdom and we make up legends to kind of illustrate how significant this was. And those who excel in it, we celebrate. We look at this and be like, "Oh my goodness, what a wise king in this way." And I think one of the reasons that I can justify this idea of, oh, it's a legend that was made up to try and justify somebody who I genuinely think Solomon operated with a high level of wisdom and these stories came in after the fact is because this is, the theologians talk about this as a folk novella, meaning this shows up in other cultures. Other cultures, distant, far away, previous to even Judaism, have examples of this happen. In fact, in the Indian culture, the Buddha has a story just like this. Two women come up, "This is my kid, no, this is my kid." He, in this story, doesn't have a sword to cut him in two. He says, "Tie a rope around the legs of one, somebody tie a rope around the hands of the other one, and let's do a little tug of war, and whoever wins the tug of war, that's who the mom is." And then one of the women says, "No, I don't want my kid to be stretched out and hurt in this way. Fine, she can have him or whatever." And then the Buddha says, "All right, that's the true mother." So it's a similar story. So how do we make sense of that? I think this is a way of people going, here's a legend, here's a story to do this. The point of it though is we valorize and we lionize people who figured these things out, who operate with high levels of discernment. Why? Because we spend a lot of our times with regrets thinking all the signs were there. I'm not good at this. We either do one of two things. We build ourselves up when we look back and we've realized we made the right decision. But when we look back at our life and we know we've made a bad decision, we live with regrets of it, we think to ourselves, man, how did I miss that? How did I not see that? Maybe we say nobody saw that coming, which kind of gives us an excuse. And then we say, how did we miss that? And then at the worst of the case, all the signs were there. I just missed it. And we give ourselves far too much grief because we think it should have been so obvious to us. And now, of course, it is obvious, but then it wasn't. And it's hard for us to place our minds back in the pre-things, back pre-situation. We fail to see how much noise there was and how hard it was to discern, because all we know is after the fact how easy it was to see it. And unfortunately, with that, then we don't give ourselves enough credit. We operate with a level of grief. We carry this baggage with us. How could I be somebody who missed that? All the signs were there with this. We should be able to do better than this. We retell and celebrate stories of people who have successfully done it because it inspires us to want to be better. And we think we should be better at this. We look at people who successfully beat the market all the time and we're like, that's who I want to be, right? We look at people who bought in 2008 instead of got foreclosed in 2008 and we're like, man, I wish I was that smart. I wish I had the foresight to be able to do some of those things. We think we should be better at what we do. I should be better. I live with this overwhelming like kind of thing of like, I look back at my life and I should have done better. I should have done better. All the signs were there. And again, we fail to understand the situation. We fail to see things through the signal and the noise. We think everything is signal and we forget how much noise there is and how really hard this sort of thing is. And by the way, we live noisy lives. We live very noisy lives. And the purpose of today's talk to kind of kick this whole thing off is to both present the idea behind the signal and the noise and to kind of create a framework for it. But then it's also to remind you, we are not good at deciphering or distinguishing the signal from the noise. We're not good at it, guys. We suck at predictions. We look at like newscasters or meteorologists who are like, it looks like it's a 40% chance of rain. And then when it doesn't rain, we're like, this guy doesn't even know what he's talking about. They're terrible. We joke about how bad meteorologists are. And a lot of times they're operating from this like bias effect. If I say it's not gonna rain and then it does, you're mad at me. If I say it's gonna rain and it doesn't rain, you're like, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about. But it's easy because you know it's better than that. It's better than the, so we recognize, we look at it and we realize we're not good at deciphering that kind of stuff. With all the technology, you'd think we would be better at this. You've gone to the doctor and they've said, well, it could be this, or it could be this, or it could be this. And you're like, do you have a degree? You should know what this is. You should be better at decoding and deciphering what's going on with my life. Well, there's a lot of noise. You've got some issues here. We've tested this. And doctors are very careful not to be like early on, what do you think it's this? Let's just give her that. They're like, we're gonna eliminate all of the different possibilities. Why? Because over time we have figured out, in spite of our education, in spite of all of the science that we have behind us, in spite of all the tools that we have and all the money that goes into the medical profession, we are still not good at deciphering, distinguishing the signal from the noise. And this is true for you and it's true for me. When it comes to like the details of our life, we live very noisy lives. We're not good. Just so you know, you're a bad forecaster. Me too. We're all very bad at it. Which means that when we approach scenarios that are gonna be like, well, this is a big decision in life, we do it with a high level of humility, or we should. We should do it with a high level of humility, a high level of God, I open a door, close a door, do all this kind of stuff. Let's be less confident about what we think is signal, and then also give ourselves a little bit of the benefit of the doubt on the back end when it doesn't work out, and we look back and be like, and all the signs were there, I guess I'm just an idiot. And we live with this grief, and we live with the regret, and we think, nobody else would get this wrong, but somehow I did. Now, that's not true. It's not true. That's not how this thing works. We have a problem. We're terrible at predictions. We give ourselves too much credit on the front end and too much grief when we get it wrong. And Jesus, if his disciples, one of the biggest stories of the New Testament, we'll talk about this more later in the series, but is Jesus with his disciples who would over and over again be like, hey, listen, I'm going to die. 3 days later, I'm going to rise. Listen, I'm the Son of God. And be like, yeah, whatever. We don't understand. They change the topic. They do all kinds of stuff. He's trying to drill it into their brains. And it would only be after the fact when they would write about it 20, 30, 40 years later that they would be able to be like, he was so clear with us and we missed it so much. There is no way to not read the Gospels and realize the disciples were terrible at predictions. That they were awful at this, that they missed the signal because of the noise. And we can joke about it and we can laugh at them and we can mock them, but we should be pointing the finger back at ourselves and be like, you know who else sucks at predictions? This guy. Me, I do. And I live an awfully noisy life. So for the next 3 weeks, we're gonna talk about why that doesn't have to be all there is to the story, that doesn't have to be the end of it. That perhaps there are strategies for minimizing that or learning from that or getting better at deciphering and distinguishing the signal from the noise. Perhaps there's room for growth. Perhaps God wants something more for us. Perhaps a little attention spent on this area can help us prevent unfortunate decisions that we later regret. And maybe, just maybe, we can get a little bit better at discerning the signal from the noise. So I got a couple of questions to kind of end with today. It's a beginning of a series. This is how I always try and do a series, with maybe perhaps less of a steps to go on, rather than kind of create the problem for you and let you sit on it and wrestle with it and be like, you got to come back to kind of get more of that. I can't reveal my whole hand on it. So this is what I want to do. I put together three questions that would be fantastic things to kind of walk through if you came with somebody that you're doing life with, or you have a friend who lives a very noisy life, noisier than you, maybe is a worse predictor than you, right? Have so many things that they, and right now you're being like, this is really obvious, and all the signs are there, and you just keep going down this path like, you should listen to this talk that my pastor gave this week. You know, try and do it like in a very passive way. Like, we'll have to figure out how to do this in a strategic way. Or your kids, you got a high school student that is needs to hear this, right? This is the classic so-and-so needs to hear this, when the reality is we all need to hear this. You know what I mean? That's how this works. A couple of questions for you to walk through and think through. Number one, what's noisy in your life right now? What's noisy in your life right now? What is it that you're getting bombarded with signals or things that there's just like, I've got a major decision to make, and like there's especially noise in this area. I've got a lot of things, a lot of voices. I got a lot of stress because there's a lot of things affecting this. There's financial implications. There's relational implications. There's family implications. There's work implications. If I say yes to this, I have to say no to this. And if I say no to this, I have to say yes to this. What's noisy in your life right now? Number two, who comes to mind when you think of someone who operates with discernment? Some people are better at this than others. And by better, I mean they don't always get it right, but I mean it seems like they have more humility when they are approaching something and less regrets about it later, and more grace for themselves and not beating themselves up for missing it when everything seems so obvious at the time. Who operates with a high level of discernment? Not that you have to sit down with them for 20 minutes, interview them, or do whatever, but like just notice it. Like somebody in your life does. Somebody in your life you've respected and been like, there's a level of wisdom there that I hope I have. And it really sucks when they're younger than you, because you can always write it off to age and be like, oh, it's when I'm older. And then like, they're smarter than me and they're 30. And so that sucks. Obviously something else is happening there. And then the last one is this. What bad decision do you have a hard time forgiving yourself for? Because all the signs were there. And this one's painful, and this one hurts, and this is really at the heart of it. And this is life work here. You know what I mean? Because this probably is something that you and your counselor can figure do this. This isn't like an easy sitting on the back patio with somebody, and this doesn't come up in conversations. You know what I mean? But what bad decision? And it was a bad decision. And you know it. You don't need somebody to be like, that was bad. You're like, I know it's bad. What bad decision do you have a hard time forgiving yourself for? Because you in your mind have lived with the idea that all the signs were there. And I just somehow missed it. I confused the noise with the signal. I missed the signal because of all of the noise. And after the fact, in the same way that on December 8th, we'd be like, we are so stupid for thinking that sabotage was our greatest thing. We grouped it all together. We did not just do inaction. We took the worst possible action. We did the opposite of what we should have done. It would have been better for us to completely ignore it. Instead, we grouped it all together and said, right here, this would be a great target to hit. And we lost more in that day of fighting than like the rest of the war. It was like, or any other day in the rest of the war. That was a huge loss for us. And we were part of, we made it easy. We made it easy for our own potential failure. So, absolutely regret. What bad decision do you have a hard time forgiving yourself for because all the signs were there? Next week, we'll continue talking about this, looking at this from a different perspective, and perhaps there might be something here to help us move forward in determining the difference between the signal and the noise. Let's pray. Father, our prayer is that you would help us, that over and over again, we valorize wisdom, that Solomon was valorized and lionized as somebody who operated with wisdom. Obviously, Jesus would be somebody in the New Testament, but we see pictures of this, that we look at it, and even some of the Psalms talk about, man, oh, if we could just have a higher level of discernment than we currently do, and then that we feel like somehow our faith can interact with this and help us to see a bigger, broader picture and make better decisions and live with less regrets, but then also not live with the shame that comes with us feeling like all the signs were there and somehow I missed it. So I pray that you would help us work through these thoughts and these questions, that you would bring us back together again to kind of continue to explore what that might look like and how we can be people who are a little bit more adept at discovering and discerning the signal in spite of the noise. Give us the wisdom to know what to do with that and courage to act on in your name. Amen.
Thanks again for listening. If you've got more questions about the church or community group options for connecting with East Lakers outside of Sunday mornings, I'd encourage you to check out our website, eastlaketricities.com, or better yet, download our app by searching East Lake Tri-Cities in your favorite app store.